Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. I'm Jamie Beebe.
And I'm Jake Deptula. We're the host of the Strictly Stalking podcast.
Strictly Stalking is a true crime podcast that explores stalking stories told by the survivors in their own words.
Join us every Tuesday as we interview survivors, advocates, and experts to give you a deep dive into the workings of a stalking case.
Would you know where to turn if you or someone you know is being stalked? We'll also give you the resources to fight back, know your rights, and get justice.
Find Strictly Stalking wherever you listen to podcasts, from Podcast One.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 273 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what is going on with you?
Hey, man, I'm good. How about yourself?
Doing real well.
Yeah.
Just got back from my daughter's national dance thing.
Dance moves?
There's a lot of dance moves going on. Yeah. It was a whole week, so we're trying to recover from that.
Did you do some moonwalking?
No moonwalking. No dancing on my part.
Oh, okay.
I'm just a spectator.
I gotcha.
Hey, let's go ahead and give our shout outs. For Patreon, we had Gina Bixler.
Hey, Gina.
Miranda Pelham.
Well, thank you, Miranda.
Nancy Jackson.
What's going on, Jackson?
Karen Corindian jumped out at our highest level.
Corindian.
Kelly Bates.
Hey, Kelly.
Samantha.
Appreciate that, Samantha.
Maddie O'Dwyer.
Hey, O'Dwyer.
Brendan Owen.
Hey, appreciate that, Owen.
Ro.
What's going on, Ro?
Olivia.
Hey, Olivia.
Rosie 16.
Well, thank you, Rosie.
Matthew Henry.
What's going on, Matthew?
Denise Kim Fours.
Well, appreciate that, Denise.
Rose Rodriguez.
Hey, Rose.
Molly.
Good old Molly.
Good old Yvonne.
Oh, Yvonne, come on.
Rebecca Eckhart.
Hey, Rebecca.
Elizabeth Clark.
What's happening, Elizabeth?
Sharon Nichols.
Hi, Sharon.
Tanya Martinson.
There's Tanya.
Jens Van Meegro.
Van Meegro.
Yeah. Kel Evans.
Hey, what's going on?
Shelly Jones.
Hey, Shelly.
Paige Johnston jumped down at our highest level.
Well, thank you, Johnson.
And last but not least, Greg.
Hey, Greg.
And then if we go back into the vault.
Okay.
This week, we selected Christine Monroe.
Hey, thanks, Christine.
So appreciate the new and continued Patreon support. We had a lot of donations on PayPal for birthdays and anniversaries. So happy birthday to Lindsay Spurgeon.
Hey, happy birthday, Lindsay.
And I'm sure all these people will figure out who their donations came from. Also, happy birthday to Stephanie Hernandez.
Yeah, happy birthday.
And a happy anniversary to Jenny Gardner.
Well, anniversary, that's nice.
Yeah, it's very cool. Gibbs, right now on True Crime All the Time, we have an episode out on Olga Rutterschmidt and Helen Golay. These were two women motivated by greed who, you know, befriended homeless men, took out a bunch of life insurance policies on them, and then killed them.
Befriended them for the wrong reasons.
Exactly. But that's out now. We also dropped a new Reviews Are In on Patreon.
Say what?
Saturday.
Yeah.
It's only been like 3 years, I think, since we did one.
It's out there for a little bit of fun.
Yeah, just something fun. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I'm ready.
We're talking about the Beatrice Six. And there's one central question that I think definitely surrounds the case of the Beatrice Six, and it's how could six people be convicted of a crime that they didn't commit?
Well, that's a great question.
And it's one that, you know, we'll be analyzing as we go through this case. In February 1985, a woman was brutally murdered in her apartment. All the police had to go on was a blood type and an FBI profile. One suspect implicated another until it spiraled into 6 arrests and 5 false confessions. The Beatrice Six were a group of acquaintances who were wrongfully convicted of the murder and rape of Helen Wilson. The Beatrice Six were Joseph White, Thomas Winslow, Ada Joanne Taylor, Deborah Sheldon, James Dean, and Kathy Gonzalez. According to the Washington Post, the wrongful convictions were a product of aggressive interrogations and flawed science, entangling more and more suspects as their false memories grew more bizarre. Most of the suspects were familiar with trauma in some way. According to a later lawsuit, some were intellectually challenged. And so for most, the idea that they could have repressed something terrible didn't strike them as crazy. This is what the Washington Post wrote.
So if that's the case, you can see why we had some of these confessions.
And I want to zero in on the aggressive interrogations, because I think by and large, that's what we've seen in a lot of false confessions. You know, you can look back at a lot of cases where, you know, people were questioned for 10, 12, 14 hours, not given enough food, water,
sleep.
You would have to call that pretty aggressive. Yeah. Or, you know, think of some of the movies where the detective is pointing down and saying, I know you did it. Tell us you did it. You know, that's what I think of when I think of an aggressive interrogation.
I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and say, we would never do that.
Yeah.
But until you're sleep deprived and have that, you know, ongoing, somebody in your face nonstop, right? Question you, saying you did it, saying we're going to send you to jail for the rest of your life or worse, not eating, drinking. I mean, eventually it's going to take its toll.
And I think most people do think, I would never confess to a crime, let alone a murder,
right,
that I didn't commit.
I know you wanted to keep me up for 3 days and then question me because you felt you could get me to admit anything at that point. I didn't want to do that yet. You know, I know you wanted to do that on the Patreon episode.
Yeah, I don't think we're there yet, but it's future episode. At the time of this case, memory repression was a widespread belief among psychologists. The concept of memory repression led to a number of wrongful convictions across the U.S. The Innocence Project reports that false confessions play a role in 25% of DNA exoneration cases.
That's a big number.
It's a huge number. So obviously, if there's a DNA exoneration, you're saying the person didn't do it.
Right.
So 25% of the time, they were most likely convicted based off of a false confession that they probably recanted at some point. The other 75% is what, Gibbs? Evidence that the prosecution put forward that really didn't mean a whole lot, didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt, but the jury thought it was good enough.
Right.
I mean, we've seen that in cases as well. So let's talk about the Beatrice Six in the background of this case. According to the New Yorker, Joanne Taylor grew up on a cattle farm in Leicester, North Carolina. She was removed from her home at the age of 11 because her stepfather sexually abused her. She spent years in the foster care system. Joanne moved to Beatrice, Nebraska with her boyfriend in 1981. She was 18. She was pregnant at the time. Her boyfriend left her just 3 weeks after they moved there.
Well, she's going through some hard times.
Yeah, your boyfriend doesn't sound like a real winner. Joanne enrolled at Beatrice High School and raised her daughter alone. Joanne is gay, but had not come out yet at that point in time. People around town later said that they considered her a bully. At night, she liked to drink at the R&S, a bar downtown. Joanne later said that at that time, she was wasted, moody, and could snap very easily. She was known for making provocative statements. Child Protective Services recommended she start seeing psychologist Wayne Price, who worked with Beatrice law enforcement. Dr. Price was a former Army doctor. He also worked as a police and sheriff's department psychologist and was a sheriff's deputy. So this is important because he is law enforcement. Price diagnosed Joanne with a borderline personality disorder. In 1985, he recommended that she surrender parental rights. So Joanne gave her daughter up for adoption and moved to Los Angeles, where she became a sex worker. But a few months later, she moved back to Beatrice with Joseph White. White was a 22-year-old pornographic filmmaker whom she had met in LA. He wanted to help Joanne fight for custody of her daughter. Joanne and White started spending time with some of Joanne's old high school classmates. Some of them participated in making pornographic films, but this was a group that the Beatrice police took notice of. They were often seen walking down the streets late at night. It sounded to me, Gibbs, from the research, as though they were keeping tabs on them or they were noticing them at the very least, as a group maybe that they needed to keep an eye on.
Maybe a little unruly.
Maybe. But just a few months after Joanne moved back, Helen Wilson was murdered. Helen Wilson was a 68-year-old grandmother living in Beatrice. She liked to play bingo and volunteer at the nursery at the Methodist church near her apartment. Helen lived in an apartment at 212 North 6th Street. And one of the things that I saw, Gibbs, was that the building where her apartment was used to be the Lincoln Telephone and Telegraph Office, where, you know, what they called telephone girls would literally connect your calls.
That's what my mom did.
I know. I remember you talking about the fact that your mom did that.
Sometimes she would listen in on some of those calls.
Sometime in the 1950s, the building was converted into apartments. The tenants were mostly older women or single working women. Her son visited her on Tuesday the 5th until about 10:30 p.m. But later that night, a killer or killers entered Helen's apartment by prying open her door. They raped and suffocated her. Neighbors didn't report seeing anyone suspicious in the area. Helen's sister lived next door to her. Helen was sick with a cold or the flu, so her sister went to check on her on the morning of the 6th. At 9:30 a.m., Helen was found dead in her apartment. The front door was open. The apartment was a mess, and a pot of coffee had been brewed during the night with several coffee cups on the counter. A torn piece of a $5 bill was found on the floor near her purse. Helen was lying on the floor face up. Her hands were bound. Her face had a scarf wrapped very tightly around it. And it was described as being so tight that the pressure flattened her nose.
Someone had to really tie that very tight to make that happen.
The killer or killers then covered her face with a towel. Her nightgown was lifted above her waist. So police, once they got on the scene, they began investigating, assumed that sexual assault rather than robbery was the motive, because really nothing of value was missing from Helen's apartment.
You got to wonder, if you cover her face with a towel, is that because you don't want to see her face when you're sexually assaulting her, because she's somebody you know, or because she reminds you of somebody?
Or is it that a killer would cover up a person's face after they were dead? You know, there are things that police usually make out of that, but I think a lot of times it boils down to they believe it's done because the person knows the victim.
Yeah.
They don't want to have to see their face. Helen's preliminary autopsy took place on February 6th. Type B non-secretor blood was found on Helen's mattress, wall, and underwear. Semen was found in both her vagina and her rectum. She had several defensive wounds to her hands and arms. She had a broken arm and ribs from fighting off her attacker or attackers.
You know, for a tiny woman, she was not going to give up easy.
No, and it's so sad. you know, when you think about what this woman went through that night, the fear, the injuries, the vicious sexual assault, and then obviously losing her life.
Yeah.
The FBI's profile described the killer as a loner who'd had psychological counseling and collected pornography and who was, quote, odd and wimpy. And you know, Gibbs, I've talked on TCAT episodes, TCAT Unsolved episodes. I'm fascinated by FBI profiles. You know, some to me seem so vague,
right,
that they could apply to any case, to almost, you know, anyone or a large percentage of the population. So now we're in the 1980s, and you know, you think back about Bundy and his talk about pornography.
Yeah.
I wonder how much that played into FBI profiles that then came along.
Well, I think it probably played into it. How much? I don't know.
Because it's very specific,
yeah.
Right? Collected pornography. Why? Was it because there was a sexual assault? And then the phrase odd and wimpy. Wimpy.
Because the killer bound the hands? Would that make them wimpy?
I don't know. That's why, you know, without the background or without the reasoning of how they came up with the profile, you know, it's hard sometimes for me to understand them. And as we've seen police do in a number of cases, they planted a voice-activated tape recorder at Helen's gravesite, hoping that her killer or killers would come back and talk to her, I guess. We've seen this happen before. Yeah,
stand over the grave and say, oh, I'm sorry I did this to you.
Right.
Please forgive me.
And maybe that has something to do with the covering of the face. We've also seen where, you know, there's been surveillance at the gravesite. Police also approached the owner of an adult bookstore to ask for a list of known homosexuals. And it was because Helen had been sexually assaulted anally. I don't think I've seen that in any other case that we've done.
Yeah, it is the 80s, but it just seems a strange way of thinking.
Yeah, it does to me. They interviewed over 300 people. One of whom was Joseph White. He didn't know who Helen Wilson was. He was eliminated as a suspect because he didn't have the correct blood type. 3 weeks after Helen was murdered, Joanne Taylor moved back to North Carolina. According to the New Yorker, Helen's case quickly went cold, but a hog farmer named Burdett Searcy, a former police officer, promised Helen's daughter that he would solve the case. So he's not a police officer. He's a former police officer, but he's on the case.
He's on the case.
He began interviewing people, and he started with people who roamed around town, didn't have jobs, people that, you know, he thought were vagabonds. He was hired as a deputy at the Gage County Sheriff's Office in 1987. But he continued to look into Helen's case. Even though the Beatrice Police Department was in charge, he occasionally stopped Dr. Wayne Price to bounce ideas off him. Gibbs, this guy was so obsessed with Helen's case that the sheriff told him that he was tired of hearing about it. He told him, if you think you can solve it, then get it done.
Yeah, just do it. Quit talking about it.
By 1989, police were looking for suspects who they said were sexually unconventional and who collected pornography. And again, this had to have been, at least in part, based on the FBI profile.
Sure.
Joseph White and Joanne Taylor seemingly fit that description. We talked about, you know, the fact that White was a pornographic filmmaker. In March 1989, Searcy drafted an arrest warrant for Joanne Taylor and Joseph White, based on evidence he gathered when he worked as an unpaid PI. He heard from a 17-year-old informant that the two had bragged about the murder. He wrote in his memo that White was gay and a very strange young man, and Joanne was very nervous in the days following the murder. Okay, the first part, if you're saying someone is saying that they bragged about the murder, that's one thing.
Right.
The other part, a very strange young man. You're saying he's gay, and then you're saying Joanne was very nervous. I don't think that's evidence for an arrest warrant.
I don't think so either. I think, you know, you can say it's a reason to bring them in to speak to them.
Sure. So at first, only Joseph White and Joanne Taylor were accused of the murder, but type B non-secretor blood was found at the crime scene, which did not match either of their blood types. So police believed more people were involved. Remember, we already said Joseph White was clear.
Yeah.
He was eliminated as a suspect because, you know, his blood type didn't match. On March 15th, 1989, Searcy, Dr. Price, and Sheriff Jerry DeWitt flew to Holly Pond, Alabama, White's hometown, to arrest him. He was interviewed on March 16th. They interrogated him about his sexuality. White told them he was bisexual, but that his involvement in the murder was pure, deep bullshit.
What's the way? If you didn't do it, that's the way to call it out. Bullshit.
Call bullshit. He insisted from the beginning that he didn't know about the murder. He didn't know Helen Wilson. He was told he was having difficulty remembering because he didn't want to remember. Now, he insisted he wasn't there. Police threatened to test his blood, hair, and semen, and White promised that testing would prove he was innocent. So, you're threatening me to do some forensic testing, and I'm saying, as a person who knows he's innocent, please, by all means,
bring it on.
What other tests you got? Let's do every test just so we can knock this out and I can go home.
But nothing worse when you know you didn't do something and someone is telling you, oh, no, no, you did. You're just suppressing it.
Yeah, you just don't, you're not remembering things correctly because you don't want to remember them that way. And this was a theme, right, that followed. Dr. Price eventually would suggest to each member of this group that they couldn't remember what happened because they were blocking them out. The memories were too traumatizing. And when they eventually made their confessions, they all gave inaccurate and inconsistent stories. Joanne Taylor was also arrested on March 15th and questioned by Searcy on March 16th. He only spoke with White and Taylor for a few hours. He told them about the murder and didn't record the conversation until the point where they were ready to confess. And Gibbs, this is something I've seen happen, you know, especially in cases that go back to like the 80s, 70s, right. 80s, not recording the entire thing, doing a bunch of stuff out for hours and hours, and then hit and record when the person is ready to give the statement you want them to give.
Yeah, once you're happy with how that information is going to flow out of their mouth.
And it reminds me so much of that documentary, The Innocent Man,
yeah,
which I think is very good. I've talked about it. I've watched it many times on Netflix. But you see that exact same tactic used in some false confessions that were made in those cases as well. True Crime All the Time Unsolved is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to Gibby and I talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Get an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Oh, Gibby, you know I love that sound. It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. You know, we've been using Shopify for at least 4 years now for our podcast merchandise website. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. I saw a huge difference when we switched to Shopify. They just make everything so easy. You get analytics. It makes fulfillment a breeze. Like mine, Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. I love how they have an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to Shopify.com/unsolved, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/unsolved right now. Shopify.com/unsolved. Taylor's confession video starts after she admitted to the crime, and she said that Joseph White pressured her into it. But she struggled to recall details in the video, saying, "I block a lot of bad things out. I always have. I have problems. There's a lot in my childhood I can't remember." And I think that's why it was important to talk about her childhood, the trauma. And I'm sure there were things in her childhood that she had blocked out. Taylor told detectives that she was told she was at Helen's apartment by the police officers who brought her to jail.
So the police are feeding her information. They're bringing her into the interview and saying, "Oh, you know you were at the apartment."
But she doesn't remember it.
Yeah.
Taylor and White were brought back to Beatrice. Joanne requested private counseling with Dr. Price. Price told Joanne that her memories might come back in her dreams. But she told a second psychologist, "In my head and in my heart, I know I was not there." But after more interviews with police, she became convinced that she committed the crime. Joanne started to recall more details and always cried when she recalled Helen being raped. Joanne Taylor confessed to suffocating Helen with a pillow while Joseph White raped her. Now, initially, she said that Helen was raped in a white single-story house with a porch, and this was reported by many outlets, Gibbs, to be a house very similar to Joanne's childhood home. But when investigators told her that it happened in an apartment, Joanne suddenly remembered that it occurred in an apartment. She said that she remembered herself screaming, "Stop, don't, it hurts, leave her be." So you mentioned it, right? We're seeing some signs here of information feeding, information correcting.
Yeah.
You know, these are normally not good signs.
No.
And, you know, when you look at folks like the Innocence Project, these are the type of things that they point to as bad police interrogation techniques. This is what you're not supposed to do.
It's not good if you got to force information into your suspect's head.
According to the New Yorker, Joanne told Searcy, "I don't know if it's the connection between the past rape and what I'm seeing at the time, but that's what runs, what I hear. I hear it as clear as a bell." After she saw photos of the crime scene, Joanne said that she was the one who suffocated Helen, but it was out of compassion. She said, "I know with my rape, my father's face has haunted me all my life. I didn't want her to see the face that would haunt her. I did not realize I was killing her." I think the other thing that's obvious is that you're seeing her past,
right,
come back into this current situation. The description of her childhood home, the sexual abuse by her stepfather.
It's like she's tangling the two together.
Yes.
And with them showing her pictures of the crime scene, you know, she could potentially pull that information out of those pictures and put it into her head.
Sure. You could get details from those pictures and then use them or craft them into the story.
Believing you were actually there.
Yeah. Because now you're seeing it.
Yeah.
Ralph Stevens, a Beatrice police officer, thought that Taylor was having delusions. But when he told the sheriff what he thought, he was told that he was muddying the waters. The police department was removed from the case shortly after this because they questioned the direction of the county sheriff's office. According to the New Yorker, Joanne's first confession mentioned seeing another boy in Helen's apartment. She said he was not real slender, not real bulky, hair not black, but not real blonde.
It's all kind of all over the place.
That is a mess. She looked through a lineup of six men and picked out Thomas Winslow, a high school classmate. Winslow was 23 years old with blonde hair. He, too, was one of Dr. Price's former patients. Price diagnosed him with depression after he tried to end his life. He wrote about Winslow, does seem to obsess about not hurting others. He focuses on the discomfort of others and tries to make everyone feel better. So Winslow was interviewed on February 13th, 1989 by Searcy. He was in jail on a felony assault charge. Searcy had also spoken to him back in 1985. Winslow admitted that he lied about where he was on February 5th, 1985. He said he was at work, but admitted that he had let Joanne Taylor, Joseph White, and Cliff Sheldon borrow his car. Searcy omitted the mention of Cliff Sheldon from his report because Sheldon was at the hospital on the night of February 5th.
Well, if he mentioned him, then that meant that the information he got couldn't be correct, because if they were all three together,
how could they be?
Exactly.
If Sheldon was at the hospital. So it's a big point, right? You're leaving it out on purpose because it conflicts with the narrative that you want. Winslow was arrested on March 17th, 1989. According to the New Yorker, Winslow was interviewed again, but the recording didn't start until after he accepted blame for the crime. He said he was pressured to go with Joanne and White, but ran away when he heard Helen scream. He said that he worked at the Beatrice Good Samaritan Center with Jan, Helen's granddaughter, and he was overwhelmed with guilt. At one point, he said, "Do you know how it was at work? When Jan was crying on my shoulder and not to tell her, do you know how low that makes me feel because I've held it for this long?" It was determined that Wilson did not have type B blood.
Well, that's a problem because they know that type B blood was left at the crime scene.
So what does that mean? We got to find somebody else that was involved that does have type B blood.
We got to keep searching.
Deborah Sheldon was targeted because she hung out with the group. Deborah was Helen Wilson's grandniece and hung around in the same friend group as Joanne Taylor. Her husband, Cliff, was friends with Winslow. Like Taylor, Sheldon was sexually abused by her stepfather as a child. According to the New Yorker, one police officer said that she maybe hung out with these people because, you know, maybe it brought a little importance to herself. Another police officer wrote that she may not do well on an IQ test because of deprivation as to cultural background. A psychologist wrote, she is essentially incapable of defending an independent opinion.
Wow, that's a big statement.
It is, but what does it mean? That she goes along with a group or along with others? She doesn't have her own thoughts or can't stand up for herself. She's a follower.
Yeah.
That's what I'm taking from that. Deborah was first interviewed on March 24th, 1989. In her first interview, Deborah said she helped three people get into the apartment. When she saw what they were doing, she tried to stop them, but Joseph White pushed her away. The problem is, Gibbs, she didn't have type B blood either. So authorities asked her if maybe there was a fifth person in the apartment. Deborah's lawyer asked Dr. Price to meet with her because he assumed she had repressed memories. Deborah also had a previous experience with Dr. Price because in the late 70s, the child welfare office sent him to help her. Deborah had given up her parental rights, very much like Joanne had. After meeting with Price on April 14th, Deborah dreamed that her husband's friend, James Dean, was also in the apartment. So she told investigators. James Dean was arrested the very next day.
You hate to be associated with anybody in this group.
Because you're going to get arrested.
Yeah. And you better hope you don't have type B blood.
After he was arrested, a guard noticed that he was pacing, crying, and talking to himself. He waved his arms and shouted, "I've been arrested on something I know nothing about." I feel like I would be doing the same thing.
Yeah. What's going on here? I went up and got some coffee, and next thing I know, I'm arrested.
Because somebody dreamed that I was there.
You must have done it because she dreamt that you were there.
This is like my wife waking up and being mad at me because she dreamed that I cheated on her. This has happened on multiple occasions.
That's exactly what it's like.
You've heard about it at the dinner table. I'm like, I didn't do anything wrong.
You're such a bastard, Mike.
I know.
How could you do that to her in her dream?
But I mean, that's how absurd this is.
Yeah.
Right?
It is.
17 days after his arrest, Dr. Price met with Dean because he was going through some emotional distress. Dean told Price that his father and brother-in-law physically abused him as a child. Price suggested that the trauma led to a fear of violence, which caused him to repress his memories of the murder. Again, right? We said there's a theme. The theme is Searcy. The theme is Dr. Price telling all of these people that you were there.
Yeah.
You participated. You've just repressed the memories.
I just have a problem with, you know, Dr. Price, the doctor, you know, that helps people out in the community, you know, but also works for the
law enforcement agent. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where's the separation?
Yeah, exactly.
I get you. It is a good question because, you know, the doctor-patient confidentiality, you're supposed to be able to say things to a therapist.
Right.
But if the therapist is also a law enforcement person,
yeah,
he's a deputy or whatever, where's the line? And is there one? Dean denied that he was involved. But by the end of the session, he began doubting himself. He said he took naps to try to have visions of things. And he realized that Joseph White reminded him of his brother-in-law and that it wouldn't surprise him if White pressured him to do something wrong because his brother-in-law did the same thing.
But these are things that he determined after meeting with Dr. Price.
Yes. And here again, we see things from a person's past kind of coming forward to cloud what's going on in the present.
Right.
According to the New Yorker, on May 8th, 1989, Dean confessed to Searcy that he was an accomplice, saying, "I feel that I remembered it in my sleep. I had a memory loss, which I didn't have no idea about none of this stuff." But Dean didn't have type B blood. So sheriff's deputies asked him to try to remember if there was a sixth person.
It's just the ongoing theme, right?
Well, we got to keep going. Yeah.
Well, we arrested you, but you don't have the right blood. So who do you know that could have been there with you?
This is almost like the worst game of telephone ever.
Honestly, you're right. It really is.
Except it's not really these people talking to each other. It's, you know, them giving bad information back and forth between themselves and the police. And he told them, "I got an idea, but I can't say, you know, I don't want to put a wrong name in there and get you guys in trouble. I'll put in the missing pieces as it comes back to me." Now, the final suspect, Kathy Gonzalez, came onto police radar because Deborah Shelton and James Dean reported that they dreamed about her being at the crime scene. And again, I'm saying these things, I sound incredulous, but I don't want it to be mistaken as though I'm really down on these people, because I think they're being pressured. They're being bamboozled in a way, you know, by both law enforcement and by this doctor who is also in law enforcement. I guess it's more about my thought of finding out that you're a suspect in a murder because somebody dreamed it. Or two people dreamed it. My wife dreamed it.
It's not even as good as hearsay, or it is hearsay, right?
I don't even think it's as good. I think you were right the first time. I don't think it's even as good as saying, well, so-and-so told me that they were there.
Yeah.
I dreamed it? I dream all kinds of, you know, unbelievable things.
Right.
I don't rush out and implicate people in you know, murders and sexual assaults. And maybe more importantly is, I think as law enforcement, why are you taking a dream as some kind of concrete thing?
Right.
That someone was involved. Kathy Gonzalez was arrested on May 25th, 1989. She lived in the apartment above Helen. She was 29 years old. Kathy thought that she was doing laundry on the night of February 5th, 1985. And this is where I think it becomes very tough to, you know, give an alibi. Who's going to remember what they did on a specific night 4 years ago?
And I'm lucky to remember what I did last night.
I know. That's the thing that's very tough about this. The psychologist told her she may have witnessed the murder and just didn't remember. But Kathy insisted she didn't have any memory problems and that she was not repressing traumatic murders.
Well, look, I'm pretty sure, and I think you are as well, if we witness a murder, we probably remember that.
It's going to stick with you.
Yeah. Now, maybe we could have witnessed people coming in and out of the building and wouldn't thought anything about it. And
yeah, that's different.
Yeah, but witness a murder, people are going to remember that.
Kathy had type B blood, but not non-secretor type B.
But she's got type B. Maybe that's all they want.
It's almost like we're getting closer. We're getting closer. Now, I don't know how we're getting closer if we're the police. Dr. Price visited Kathy 2 days after she was arrested. He told her that she was sane and that she knew right from wrong. Kathy was distressed because she vividly remembered being sexually assaulted by an uncle.
Yeah, so if she can remember being assaulted by her uncle, why wouldn't she remember being a witness to a murder?
What would be another very traumatic event. According to Cinemaholic, she said in her interview, "I've done my share of little sins, but we're talking about killing an old person. I mean, why would I block this out? I mean, it had to be pretty bad." At the Gage County Jail, Kathy confronted Joanne and Deborah and asked them why they thought she was there. Deborah told her, "I don't know. I just remember you." Joanne said, "I don't remember you being there." So, I mean, I think, you know, if I'm in Kathy's position and I've got people saying they dreamed I was there or police believe that I was there based on your statements, I'm going to want to confront those people.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important that Joanne actually did say, "Hey, I don't remember you being there." According to the Innocence Project, while there were serious inconsistencies between the suspect's stories and the crime details, no further investigation appeared necessary, especially once James Dean, Deborah Shelton, and Kathy Gonzalez falsely confessed after intense police interrogation. Dean and Sheldon's confessions relied heavily on details they allegedly recalled from their dreams about the crime. I know this is an episode that is going to make a lot of people angry.
Yeah. I mean, you're basing confessions on dreams.
And not only that, but once you have these so-called confessions, you're done. Now, I think that was fairly normal back then. If you could get people to confess, what else did you need? I know for a fact that we know a lot more about false confessions today than people did in the 1980s.
Oh, for sure.
I'm sure if you polled most people, they would not say that they believed police coerced people into confessing.
Yeah.
And I think if you did that same poll today, it would come out much differently.
Oh, big time differently.
By the end of the investigation, Taylor, Sheldon, and Dean thought they were guilty. On April 24th, 1989, Deborah Sheldon pleaded guilty to aiding and abetting second-degree murder and received a 10-year sentence. She told the judge, "I was there at the scene, and I should be properly punished." On May 17th, 1989, James Dean pleaded guilty to aiding and abetting second-degree murder and received a 10-year sentence. On September 1st of that year, Joanne Taylor pleaded guilty to causing the death of Helen Wilson intentionally, but without premeditation. She was sentenced to 10 to 40 years. Kathy Gonzalez pleaded no contest to aiding and abetting second-degree murder. On October 5th, she was sentenced to 10 years. Now, Joseph White refused to plead guilty and went to trial. The only evidence against him was the other confessions. The New Yorker wrote, "By then, he had become the object of their projections. He was the evil stepfather, the abusive brother-in-law, the bully, the monster in all their lives." And I thought this was really interesting from the New Yorker because it does make a lot of sense.
It really does.
I don't know how Joseph White became this evil person to all of these other people, but it does seem like he did.
Yeah. I mean, somehow either on their own or with somebody's help.
And that's where I was going to head to, because I think at a certain point, all but him began to believe that they were guilty, that they were there. He was the one that never did. So were the police saying to these other people, what had to have been Joseph White, he must have been the person that got you all into it.
Right. The ringleader.
The boogeyman. Whatever you want to call it. At his trial, Joanne Taylor testified against White. White's attorney asked her if she could separate her memories of Helen's murder and what Price and the police officers suggested to her. Joanne said no. It would almost be impossible to separate. White's attorney asked her to remember what she remembered, and she could not recall anything. So I think a pretty smart line of questioning. You can see that really trying to dig in on the fact that the police were feeding
right
the details. And that's where, you know, all these people got them. Tell me what you remember on your own. I don't remember anything.
If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't recall anything.
Dean and Sheldon also testified. White's defense attorney noticed that they gave different statements about White at first, but by the time they went to trial, their stories kind of all seemed to be the same.
Kind of like they were coached up?
Yeah, I don't know if coached up is the right word. I think I'm back to the kind of feeding or molding. And maybe you could use the word. Maybe they all mean the same thing.
Giving them the consistent information
that
they can utilize.
Yeah, there was a consistency. Now, how do you get that consistency? It's either because you were all there,
right,
or you all got the same information.
Exactly.
Joseph White was convicted of first-degree murder on November 9th, 1989, and sentenced to life in prison. And that just shows you something that you and I have talked about numerous times. The difference between pleading guilty and saying, no, I'm not guilty, taking your chances and losing. A lot of times there's a big difference and the hammer comes down much harder on you when you do that.
The other's got 10 years. He got life.
Now, they also went after him for first degree murder. So obviously that's a big difference.
Sure.
On December 8th, Winslow pleaded no contest to a charge that he did aid, abet, procure, or cause another to cause the death of Helen Wilson intentionally, but without premeditation. He was sentenced to 50 years.
So pretty close to what Joanne got, right? She got 10 to 40.
10 to 40. Joanne Taylor was transferred to the Nebraska Correctional Center for Women. A psychiatrist wrote that she experienced flashbacks and feared losing control of her mind. Her attorney and her own family believe she was guilty. Deborah Sheldon was an ideal prisoner, so she was allowed outside to do lawn maintenance. A year after Dean received his sentence, he started to doubt his guilt. He later said, "It came to me. You know, what did I do? I wasn't involved in this thing." He analyzed legal texts to see if he could withdraw his plea, but he realized that he couldn't.
Can you imagine sitting in your cell and one day just coming to realize,
what in the hell have I done?
I was never there.
And not only what have I done to myself, but what was I a part of that caused all these other people who I know for a fact weren't there?
Yeah, especially White,
who
got life.
First degree. Gonzalez, Dean, and Sheldon agreed to plead guilty. We talked about that. But they also testified against Joseph White in exchange for shorter sentences. They served 4.5 years and were released in 1994. Winslow, Taylor, and White served 18 years before they were released. Joseph White spent years fighting for the truth. He worked in the woodshop at the Nebraska State Penitentiary and saved his money for a lawyer. You're going to have to save a lot of money because I don't believe they pay very well.
I don't think they pay minimum wage.
In prison. In 2001, Nebraska passed a law that allowed people convicted of serious crimes to seek DNA testing. So obviously, you know, White wanted his DNA tested. He wanted them to do all those tests back when he was first interviewed.
Well, for sure. So this is a great opportunity for him. This is something he wants. He feels it's going to prove that he had nothing to do with this.
Thomas Winslow was repeatedly raped in prison, which caused him to shut down emotionally. He was reluctant to have the DNA testing done because he had accepted that he had committed the crime. He just couldn't remember it. But in 2006, White and Winslow made their first request for DNA testing. County Attorney Richard Smith denied their motion for testing, but the Nebraska Supreme Court ultimately approved it. In 2007, White and Winslow appealed their convictions. DNA testing was completed in August 2008. They were both excluded as suspects, and James Dean was eventually excluded as well. They were officially exonerated of the crime. White was released on October 15th, 2008, and his conviction was vacated. On October 17th, Winslow was resentenced to time served and released. Dean, Gonzalez, and Sheldon had already been released, and the attorney general encouraged them to file applications for pardon. So, you know, talking about pleading versus going to trial. Okay, I mentioned it. You lose at trial, the hammer's going to come down on you.
Yeah.
But later on, you do have some options available to you that maybe the others don't have who pleaded guilty.
Yeah.
On November 7th, 2008, the attorney general held a press conference identifying Helen Wilson's killer, a man named Bruce Allen Smith. The attorney general blamed County Attorney Richard Smith and other investigators for being too eager to solve the crime. Attorney General John Bruning said, "These new developments came about for two reasons: the high quality of evidence preserved by the Beatrice Police Department and White's dogged persistence in proving his innocence."
Yeah, good thing he was persistent.
Yeah, because I think it could be easy for some
to
say, it doesn't matter what I do, they're never going to let me out of here. So I'm just going to sit here and read my books or do whatever.
Yeah. And if he didn't pursue it, Winslow still be sitting in prison too, because he didn't really want to pursue it at first.
Yeah, you got to give him a lot of credit. Now, he knew he was innocent.
Yeah.
And I think you and I would both say the same thing. We'd never give up.
Right.
If you knew you were innocent, man, it would just eat at you every day.
You have to keep fighting.
After White and Winslow were excluded based on DNA evidence, the attorney general's office assembled the task force to follow up on all leads in the original case files. It took them about 2 months until they found a match, Bruce Allen Smith. It turned out that Smith was an original suspect. He had a criminal record, and his grandmother lived in Helen's building in 1985. Smith was born on August 22nd, 1962, which made him 22 at the time of Helen's murder. He had no connections whatsoever to the Beatrice Six. Smith was arrested in Oklahoma City in the 1980s for drug possession, car theft, DWI, and rape. In 1983, he married, and he and his wife had triplets. Tragically, two of them died at birth. Smith arrived in Beatrice on February 4th, 1985, to stay with friends. He partied on the night of the 5th. He drank at a bar in Beatrice and drove with his friends to an after party in Blue Springs, Nebraska. Reportedly, a woman refused his sexual advances, and he threatened to rape her that night. A friend drove him back to Beatrice. He got out of the car just one block from Helen's apartment. Police believe he broke into Helen's apartment, beat her, raped her multiple times, and suffocated her. At 6 a.m. on February 6th, the convenience store clerk saw Smith trying to steal some chips. They thought that he had blood on him. On the 9th, he got on a bus back to Oklahoma, and he never returned to Beatrice again. But like I said, Gibbs, he was a suspect from the very beginning. Investigators tracked him to Oklahoma and got samples of his blood, saliva, and pubic hair on March 6, 1985. But apparently the blood testing done cleared him as a suspect. Smith was later arrested for trespassing and theft. In August of 1987, he was convicted of burglary and served time until December of 1989. He died of AIDS on September 29th, 1992 at a hospital in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma forensic analyst Joyce Gilchrist tested Smith's DNA to semen found at the crime scene, but found no connection. Her work was later discredited, and she was found partially responsible for three wrongful convictions.
That's big.
It's huge because, you know, you think about the science. The science is great. What happens if you have somebody that's not good at their job?
Yeah.
Or what if you have somebody that is purposefully not giving the correct results?
Either way, it's neglect, right?
Well, this woman was accused of forging evidence in hundreds of cases. She was fired in 2001 for fraud. Now, she was never charged with a crime, but the state had to review 1,500 cases that she worked on after she was fired.
I am certain if I was a defense attorney in that area and knew that she worked on evidence in a case, I would want to go back to court.
Yeah, well, we said at a minimum, there were three wrongful convictions that resulted from work that she did.
Yeah.
I don't know how you live with that.
I don't either. I don't know how you feel good about yourself.
Joanne Taylor was released on parole on November 10th, 2008. Joseph White's charges were dismissed the very same day. But White was fearful that the state would refile new charges against him until the announcement came out about Bruce Smith.
Yeah, he had to feel real good about that.
And what I found so fascinating, and maybe it's sad too at the same time, was that when some of these individuals in the group found out that they had been excluded based on DNA evidence, they didn't believe it.
Yeah.
That's how much they were in their own heads about the fact that they had done or participated or been at the scene of this horrible crime.
Wait, you mean I wasn't really there? Imagine
I spent all these years believing that I was. On January 26, 2009, Joanne Taylor, Thomas Winslow, Deborah Sheldon, James Dean, and Kathy Gonzalez were all pardoned by the state. And rightfully so. They should have been.
Yeah.
Investigators found that the five confessions were false and made under the threat of the death penalty. The six were also told by the Gage County Sheriff detectives and Dr. Price that they had murdered Helen, despite having no memories of doing so. They were told that their memories were repressed. And we mentioned it earlier, right? They were all told that they were just repressing these memories.
Yeah.
So Dr. Price doesn't look real great in this story, but he has maintained his innocence over the years. Dr. Rena Roy, the original Nebraska State Patrol forensic scientist who analyzed blood and semen from the crime scene, was never called to testify. Her initial determination was that none of the six had a specific match to DNA at the crime scene. Man, I think as a defense attorney, you get that person up there, you get them to say that.
Yeah.
Seems pretty big. But would it be enough, Gibbs? Okay, it's not a specific match, but all these people have confessed. You know, how big is a confession to a jury? I think it's huge.
Pretty big, yeah.
According to the New Yorker, Eli Chesson, a psychologist who evaluated the group after they left prison, told the paper that they suffered from Stockholm Syndrome. They still believed to varying degrees that they had blood on their hands. Their new beliefs superseded their previous life experiences, like paper covering a rock. And Eli called Dr. Price the Rosetta Stone, saying he implanted his own belief system into his captive patient.
Well, he did.
I don't think there's any doubt. Joseph White filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Gage County on behalf of the Beatrice Six in 2009. In the fall of 2010, White won a $500,000 settlement from the state, but he died at the age of 48 in a construction accident in 2011.
He got crushed underneath a piece of heavy equipment. How tragic is that?
He only received $25,000 before he died. His estate received the remainder, the $475,000 after his death. Now, $500,000 is not a lot of money for compensation for what happened to him.
Right.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it's not worth what he went through.
No, not at all.
But how sad is it that not only did he lose, you know, however many years of his life, but he died before, you know, he even got any of that money that could have helped him out. He could have, yeah, you know, he could have done some things.
Yeah.
According to the New Yorker, the county argued that the group should only get $300,000 each in damages, and even suggested that Winslow was at fault for being raped.
Wow.
Okay, I think if you're the county, you can argue what you believe each person should get. I don't think you should be arguing that someone is at fault for being raped.
Yeah, you put them in prison in error, and you're going to say that?
One attorney said, "Don't get me wrong, I don't think anybody should be abused like that in prison, but you saw him testify here. You saw his video. Mr. Winslow is effeminate in nature." This is not even 1985, 1989. This is less than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I can't even believe that this guy is saying these things. I'm shocked, to be honest with you. In 2016, a jury awarded the Beatrice Six $28.1 million. The judgment was three times greater than the annual budget for the entire county. The county had to increase property taxes to the maximum. The town was outraged, obviously.
Sure.
Gage County appealed, arguing that their actions should be based on their knowledge of what they thought was correct in 1989. In 2019, the county's appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court was denied, and they upheld the $28.1 million in damages. The six received their first payment in June 2019. That took a long time.
It did.
And obviously, Joseph White's payment went to his estate. Deborah Sheldon had moved to Lincoln, Nebraska. She received a $300,000 settlement and about $1.8 million from the civil suit. She's tried to stay out of the public eye since her exoneration. Kathy Gonzalez moved out of town, worked in a grocery store. She received $350,000 in compensation and about $2 million from the civil suit. James Dean received $300,000 and then $2 million in the civil suit. The jury awarded White's estate $7.3 million. Lois White told the Lincoln Journal-Star in 2019, "My main objective in all of it was to see that his name was cleared and that the folks that put him through all of that was held up to the light for the world to see." The state agreed to pay $180,000 to Thomas Winslow, But he won $7.3 million in the civil suit. Joanne Taylor moved back to North Carolina and tried to reestablish a relationship with her daughter. She said that she planned on buying a house with her settlement money. She also said that she experiences flashbacks. She told the New Yorker that she could feel herself gripping the edges of a pillow, which she used to suffocate Helen.
Wow.
Even though she knows she didn't do it.
But she has visions of it still.
And obviously she's very disturbed by these memories. She often thinks that her family believes she is a murderer, and she has to remind herself that she is not a bad person. And I find that so incredibly sad.
It really is.
That somehow she was made to believe that she actually did this. And so what goes along with that is, I'm a murderer. I'm a bad person. I mean, it's really horrible. Burdette Searcy retired in November 2016 and works at his wife's flower shop. He told the New Yorker, being on the good side of this, we don't talk. We've got 100% backing from the public in Beatrice. I am loved by my people in this community. He proposed that the group murdered Helen, and then hours later, Bruce Smith raped her. So he's not backing down.
He's saying they did it, and then Bruce came in afterwards and raped her postmortem.
And to me, it's so reminiscent of how this thing got out of control in the first place.
Yeah.
You don't have type B. We got to find somebody else. Somebody else must have been there.
Right.
So now it's just, how do we find another explanation for how these people did it?
And along the way, you're collecting all these people and keeping them corralled, saying, well, you all were there.
So Gibbs, as we wrap this one up, I mean, I just think this is a fascinating case. It's also a tragic case. It's a tragic study on false memories, false confessions. And I think it shows you the importance of a number of different things as it relates to criminal cases, psychology, interrogation techniques, competency in evidence testing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of things that went so terribly wrong in this case. And that's usually what happens that leads to these, you know, these types of false confessions.
There's still people in the community that believe the six had something to do with her murder.
And I think that was backed up by what Searcy said.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't seem to have a problem in the community, because I do think there's a lot of people still there that believes because they said they did it, they must have done it.
Yeah. Why would they say they did something so horrific?
Yeah.
If they didn't really do it, why would you ever admit to that? Well, we know why people admit to it.
And there was a number of factors that led to the false confessions. You know, I think it was the attorney general that came out and said, you know, the police's desperation to solve what was a really horrific crime.
Yeah.
We've talked about pressure on police before. It's tough. They don't want people to think that they can't protect them. So yes, they want to solve each and every murder. But you got to do it the right way.
Yeah, because this has the opposite effect too, right? Because now I'm thinking, I'm worried if I ever get pulled into the police station in that community,
I'm a goner.
Because they're going to say, well, your neighbor had a dream about you, so we're arresting you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a scary thought.
Yeah.
The police have a lot of power when you think about it. Police, and really, I mean, law enforcement in general, extending all the way into, you know, prosecutors and things like that. They have a lot of power.
Yeah.
And do some abuse it? Sure. Absolutely. We've seen examples of that all the time. Do I think it's the norm? No. And I don't think this is the norm either, but it's scary just to think that it can happen. Just like it's scary to think that faulty DNA testing or
exactly
somebody, you know, falsifying the testing could put you away for the rest of your life.
Because she didn't want to do her damn job.
Yeah.
Right? Do your job. You're getting paid to do it. You know your outcome will have a major impact on someone's life.
What? It's like, it could be life or death.
Yeah.
Or it could be, you know, spending the rest dying in prison. It's, but you know, that's it. That's it for the case of the Beatrice Six. Yeah. It's a scary one.
It is
on scary. On a number of different levels. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Hello. I am so nervous. I've been listening to your podcast for a few years now. I listen to it all the time. I love it. There are a couple cases that I tried to find, to make sure that you guys haven't done them yet. I don't think you have. The first one is a case that's really close to my heart. Her name is Crystal Dittmeyer. She was 12 years old and her stepfather allegedly, killed her. And it actually happened in the apartment complex I used to live in. So that really hit me hard. They never found her body. It was just, you know, it's a whole mess. And it's really interesting if you get into it. So, if you need any extra help or anything, I'm still here. So yeah. Second one, I think it's in England. It's, her name is Marina Wright. And, she basically went on a Tinder date and the dude is a real piece of work and, forced her out onto the balcony and then she fell to her death, unfortunately. So, it's just very harrowing. And there's a voice, you know, voice thing where you can hear it's pretty bad, but, it's pretty interesting. And, you know, it's important to remember both of them, I think. So, yeah, I'll go ahead and end it there. I feel like I talked for about 5 minutes. But love both of you guys. I don't have a favorite really. But I love you guys equally, but, yeah. All right. See you on the next one. Keep your own time ticking.
All right. Some great suggestions. We haven't done either one. So we'll make sure they're on the list.
Check them out.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Gibby. This is Christina calling, just from small town Minnesota. Just wanted to call and say I love you guys' podcast. I found you guys probably a couple years ago. I was working some 12-hour shift overnight, so you guys really, really helped me out on that one. And I've just been hooked ever since. I even got my boyfriend into listening to true crime all the time, both solved and unsolved. So we talk about that at times too. That's so fun. But I just wanted to call and let you guys know that I love your podcast. Love all you guys do. You guys are so stinking funny and I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking, guys.
Hey, wait, she's disguising her Minnesota voice.
Not everybody from Minnesota talks like that, dude.
I'm from Minnesota.
But you know what's interesting? Everybody just needs to get one other person to listen.
Exactly.
It's like a pyramid scheme kind of.
Yeah.
But we're not asking for any money.
Well.
You just need to sign up one person to listen.
Do that for us, please.
Exactly.
Hey, Mike and Fergie. I was just listening to the podcast about Peter Peterson. And I kid you not, I went to school with a girl and a boy. Their last name was Stephen. Like, not Stevens, like, just Stephen. And I kid you not, their names were Stephanie Stephen and, wait for it, are you ready? Stephen Stephen. I could not believe, even when I was in junior high, I could not believe somebody would name their child Stephen Stephen. It was bad enough, Stephanie Stephen, but why do people do that? I don't know why I felt the need to call, but that just made me think of those two people, and I haven't thought about those two people in years. Anyway, love y'all. Bye.
Stephen Stephen.
Yeah.
What's your vector, Victor?
Got to leave it at that right there.
Yeah, exactly. I got to get my airplane references in where I can. But we appreciate you calling. And I can't remember what the guy's name was in the episode. But I know I made a big deal out of people naming their kids the same first and last name. It does seem very strange. You know, you have a choice.
You do.
And so I get it. Maybe your name's Stephen Stephen and you want your son to be Stephen Stephen.
Yeah. Maybe you want to be Fergus Ferguson.
Maybe. All right, everyone. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in store and on Menards.com, and check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save